give it like a few more seconds, let a few more people join. All right, you guys ready?
Absolutely.
All right. Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to the fourth episode of Fun with the FAR. My name is Patrick Collishaw, your Fun with the FAR producer and fun facilitator. And I'm joined today by our amazing host, Steve, and our special guest, Matt Keller. Now, before we begin, I have a couple of housekeeping announcements. During the episode, I will be giving out three passwords that will pop up on the screen and that will be announced. The passwords are necessary if you are seeking CLE, CLP, or CPE credit. And to get the credit, please write the passwords down. Once the session's over, please log into the PCI website. You will see a survey with instructions on how to get credit under My Certificates and Courses. Please fill out the survey in order to get credit for the program. And if a password or poll is not available under My Certificates and Courses for you, you can submit your passwords to either Ophelia at Public Contracting Institute or to Danny at publiccontractinginstitute.com. Additionally, there may be polling questions for your participation records. We do encourage all questions and comments which may be submitted in the chat. And if you have any technical difficulties, please don't hesitate to let me know. And with that, I will pass it on to Steve and Matt.
Thank you, Patrick, and welcome all to our fourth episode of Fun with the FAR, where we'll be talking about FAR Part 7, FAR Part 10, and FAR Part 11. I am joined today and happy that he is with us, my good friend and colleague, Matt Keller. Matt, we're doing something a little different this year. If you could just very briefly provide your background and then explain to us how you got into the government contractor business.
Sure, happy to do that. I like that. My name again, Matthew Keller. I'm currently an attorney. I'm a partner at a firm in Northern Virginia, the DC area. And what I do is just work with federal government contractors on the various issues that come up in that industry. Well, how did I get into it? I was told to get into it, Steve. I was in ROTC in college. And I really wanted to be a pilot, and I went out there to be selected for jobs. And because I had a business degree, the Air Force said, you're going to be a contracting officer. And I genuinely didn't know what that meant at the time, because I never heard of the career field whatsoever. Fast forward about 2 years after I'd been stationed at Dyess Air Force Base in Texas, I just really loved doing this job. When I say this job, working within the industry to get things done. I really enjoyed the interplay between the government folks and the private sector in accomplishing various things that needed to be done. And I loved it so much that I threw away all those other dreams and decided to pursue this industry as my number one priority. So after 7 years on active duty, I went into law school, graduated in 2010, and I've been doing this attorney thing for the last 12, almost 13 years now.
And you, not only in the attorney thing, Matt, but I think you are a wonderful, wonderful source of information in government contracting. I love the fact that we've been doing this now for multiple years. And I love the fact that you can also provide us with both a buy-side perspective from your years as a contracting officer, as well as sell-side perspective, given that you currently represent contractors. So once again, welcome. I'm looking forward to our dialogue. And before I start, I just want to tell all of you participants out there that have been communicating with me via responding to those preparation assignments. Thank you so much. I'm enjoying the relationship we're building. For those of you who have not yet done that, I would encourage you to do so. It's not mandatory, but what I have always found, and I'm already experiencing with this year's participants, is the more you put in with regard to the work, the more you're going to get out of this class. I also want to remind you all that after every episode, or it might even be in the initial submission, the initial email prior to each episode, we have something called FAR Facts. And what that is a distillation of what myself and my guests feel are the most important facts or guidance that can be found in the FAR parts that we discussed that week. I find it to be a wonderful resource. I'm hoping that you all know that it's there, which is why I'm reminding you now. And I'm hoping to actually maybe look at those after the class, just to kind of refresh your recollection before we start a new FAR part. I'm also going to encourage you this year to use that raise your hand function that is built into Microsoft Teams. And also, I love the reactions that we get. So feel free to let Matt and myself know when you've got a thumbs up, whether you've got a smiley, whether you've got, or, you know, there's something that you don't necessarily understand or disagree with. Let us know. This whole Fun with the FAR series is about dialogue. Mm-hmm. It's not just a dialogue between me and my guest. It's also a dialogue with you. So any feedback that we can get from you is always appreciated. So Matt, similar to the last few years, before we jump into FAR Part 7, 10, and 11, we are going to do a review.
We're jumping in right now.
We're going to do a review of the FAR parts that we addressed 2 weeks ago. So okay. You can play along. All right, you got your Fun with the FAR shirts. Awesome.
Now that we're actually doing the thing, I wanted to make sure I'm ready to go.
You are ready. And Patrick, let's go to those review questions to see how well our participants listened to me and my prior guest, Lou Chiarella.
The first one should be up now. And Matt, I love the shirt.
And again, Matt, you can play along, but don't shout out the answer.
I'll hold back.
All right, so the question is, where may agencies publicize contract actions related to a procurement that has an estimated dollar value less than $25,000? Is it their own agency website? Is it the government-wide point of entry? Is it newspapers, or is it all of the above? Less than $25,000.
All right, it's looking like 70% of us said all of the above, and 24% of us said the government-wide point of entry.
71% of you are correct. I like that. 7 out of 10 participants who answered got this question correct. Now, remember, it's always what is the best answer. The $25,000 threshold is one of the only instances when the government is not, when the agency is not required to use the GPE, the government-wide point of entry. And if they don't use the GPE, they're supposed to use a method or approach that adequately provides to the public information. And the FAR Council tells us that those can be the agency's own website or local newspapers. And again, it's because of that smaller dollar threshold. There's always that weighing of benefits here. Also, to some extent, we need to remember that the government can use multiple sources to make a publication. And Matt, one of the things I find is often the government will use the GPE and for other potentially what I'll call very important programs, they'll also release it on their agency website as well. So one of the contract actions we talked about 2 weeks ago that needs to be publicized is a contract award. And to some extent, Matt, we talked about potential bid protest actions, which of course is tied to a certain period of time in which the government, in which the contractor knew or should have known of that contract action, an award to another competitor. So if you are engaged in a procurement and you are an interested offeror who has submitted a proposal and is waiting for award, it's always a good idea. Matter of fact, it's probably a best practice for you to make sure that when you are submitting your proposal, or you know that that the contract has already been announced, there's always a button you can push in the GPE. And again, this is assuming your contract is greater, your contract opportunity is greater than $25,000. You can push a button that provides you with a automatic push to you when another government has another notification under that procurement. That is a sure thing for you to find out when that contract is awarded. All right, Patrick, let's move on to another, the next question.
All right, next question is up.
All right. How many days before issuance of a solicitation for the procurement of a commercial item must an agency publish a synopsis notice to the GPE? Is it at least 10 days, at least 15 days, or at least 45 days, or none of the above? How many days before issuance of a solicitation for the procurement of a commercial item must an agency publish a synopsis notice? Let's see who was really paying attention 2 weeks ago. And for those of you who did the preparation assignment, this should be a slam dunk for you.
We're all over the board. We're pretty much even all the way through, but the majority of us said at least 15 days.
All right, Matt, we're talking about a commercial item procurement. You want to help us out with this, or you want me to take it?
I haven't looked at this rule in a little while, and I'll let you take it, but I'll tell you when I was doing this, the answer was zero. Commercial item didn't need to be synopsized. You're absolutely right.
And the reason for that, yeah. Matt, is under a commercial item acquisition, contracting officers like you are able to issue the synopsis with the solicitation. So you're absolutely right. The answer is none of the above. The correct answer is none of the above. Now, if we were talking about a non-commercial, it certainly would be different. It's at least 15 days. All right, Patrick, next question.
Next question's up.
All right. As a general rule, what is the minimum response time that the government must provide to contractors who wish to respond to a non-commercial solicitation? Is it 20 days, 30 days, 45 days, or none of the above? And I'm not sure if any of you are or have taken this certification for federal contract managers. These are the types of questions that you'll find on that exam.
Yeah, it's looking like vast majority of us said 30 days, 76%.
And the vast majority of you are absolutely correct. 76% of you got the answer correct. It's 30 days. Now, of course, there are instances where the government might want to provide more time. And what I've often, when I'm instructing folks on the government side, if you're dealing with a contract that is complex, or the solicitation might have a complex statement of need, if you anticipate that many primes might need to engage major subcontractors, which might require them to do some pre-work with them. 30 days might not be enough. Matt, when you were a contracting officer, what did you use as a baseline as far as reasonableness as to how much time you might want to give contractors to respond to your solicitations?
Yeah, the default was always 30 days, of course, being the rule. But when it came to complex requirements, primarily that would mean complex construction projects, we would give a lot more time, 45, 60, you know, as much time as we could, because we got so many complaints, frankly, from the offerors or the potential offerors that they needed more time. So we gave them a lot more time. But it was a complexity-based question.
And we're also, to some extent, Matt, we're going to talk about acquisition planning when we finish these review questions. And to some extent, engaging with industry prior to the release of the solicitation during that acquisition planning stage might help alleviate the need for lengthy response time as well. And we're going to talk about that later in the show. All right, Patrick, let's go to the next question.
Next question's up.
Okay, which government official must approve a sole source award of a contract that has an estimated dollar value greater than $750,000 and less than $15 million? Is it the contracting officer? Is it the chief procurement officer? Is it the competition advocate? Or is it the head of the agency? And what I'll add to this is, if you don't have the approval of this government official, to some extent, it's a faulty sole source.
All right, 66% said contracting officer.
All right, 66% of you would have been correct if it was less than $750,000. But because we're talking about a threshold above that, there's another individual within the federal government that needs to weigh in. And the FAR Council says the CEO not only has to consult with them, but that person actually needs to sign and approve the sole source award justification. And that individual is the competition advocate. The competition advocate. So the correct answer is, would be C. All right, Patrick.
All right, the final one is up.
All right, our last review question. Which of the following would not justify a sole source contract award? Is it A, natural disaster? B, contractor's possession of unique and readily available technology needed to immediately support an agency's mission? Is it C, the government's failure to plan a follow-on procurement for an ongoing agency requirement? Or is it D, national security? Which of the following would not justify a sole source contract award?
All right, 90% said government failure to plan a follow-on procurement for an ongoing agency requirement.
All right, you're absolutely correct. I'm very, very happy that is the answer that we got from our participants. Because one of the things that we learned, Matt, is there is an instance when there's some urgency and compelling need to acquire a supplier service caused by actions that's not of the government's own fault. Mm. And in this instance, the FAR Council states very clearly in FAR Part 6 that the government's failure to do what they're supposed to do, which is to adequately plan, Matt, and we're going to talk about that, for a follow-on that they know that need is going to continue, should never be used as the basis for a sole source contract award. But one of the things that we do know, Matt, is many contracts do have a continuity clause that might allow a up to a 90-day contingency period from the end of the initial, from the end date. The government will say, well, this is the firm contract end date, but we reserve to the right to extend it for 90 days. And a lot of times it's known as a bridge contract to give them time to actually award that follow-on contract. So the correct answer is, in this case, C. A, natural disaster would follow within the urgent and compelling. On the commercial side, Matt, we'd often call that a force majeure.
Sure.
B, it's the only one contractor available. Now, one of the things you may need to note is I intentionally said not only was it the only contractor who had that technology, but there was an immediate need. Because one of the things that we talked about 2 weeks ago is the simple fact that someone has a unique technology may not always be the basis to use this sole source, because the government, Matt, we're going to talk about this later in our discussion with data rights. The government often has the ability to share unique technology with other contractors and or obtain licenses for that. And of course, national security is a stated exception in FAR Part 6. So that answer is also not correct. All right. I think all in all, Patrick, I think people were paying attention. And I love that.
It looks pretty good. Yeah, I'm happy with those answers. Those are great.
And Matt, I'll let you know how well we did 2 weeks from now when we answer FAR Part review questions for FAR Part 7, 10, and 11. Now, we are still within that chapter, Chapter B, which is referred to as acquisition planning. And Matt, if I was a FAR Council member today with a magic wand, I would probably put 7, 10, and 11 before 5 and 6. Because logically, it just makes more sense to me. Because what we're going to be talking to you all today is acquisition planning. To some extent, those actions, Matt, would always precede issuing a synopsis,
right,
or issuing a contract award notice or making a sole source award decision. But I'm not the FAR Council member with a magic wand, so we'll take it as it is. So FAR Part 7. FAR Part 7 is entitled Acquisition Planning. And in the past, I've always used some really, really interesting quotes to kind of support the FAR Council's determination that planning is critical, planning is important. One of our founding fathers is quoted by saying, "By failing to plan, you are preparing to fail." A Chinese philosopher is quoted as saying, "A man who does not plan long ahead will find trouble at his door." And then lastly, a former country music star turned pop star is quoted as saying, "Just because you made a good plan, Matt, doesn't mean that's what's going to happen." The founding father, Benjamin Franklin. The Chinese philosopher, Confucius. The former country music star turned pop star, I'll give an I Had Fun With Far t-shirt. Matter of fact, the 10th anniversary edition to the first person who could tell me who that was. A former country music star turned pop star. So, all right, we got a winner. I believe Patrick confirmed for me that J.E., and I'm not sure who that is, but you're absolutely right. That singer, that philosopher, Matt, was T. Swift, Taylor Swift. So congratulations on that. Let us know your T-shirt size and where we should be sending your T-shirt, and we'll get it to you as soon as we can.
Yeah, Joshua, check the chat for my email. I'm going to put it in there and then just shoot me an email.
Okay. Lots of people. Planning is important, Matt. Planning is critical. We've talked about this. More specifically, that what Matt and I are going to talk to you about today is who, when, and how does the government create and establish an acquisition plan? We're going to be talking about whether the government should or should use commercial items versus non-commercial items in an acquisition. We're going to talk a little bit about lease-buy decisions. And then we're also going to talk about something called inherently governmental functions. So Matt, let's kick off with 7.102. Which basically lays out for us when the government shall, not should, not may, when they shall perform acquisition planning and conduct market research to promote and determine whether commercial items can meet agency needs, whether full and open competition or other than full and competition is appropriate, what particular contract type is appropriate, and whether pre-existing contracts might be in play that could be used as opposed to using a completely separate acquisition contract. So Matt, let's go to when they should perform acquisition planning to hopefully identify those four things. And the answer to that pops up in 7.104. When should acquisition planning begin? It should begin not shortly prior to when you want to issue a solicitation. The FAR Council says acquisition planning should begin as soon as an agency need is identified. And Matt, in your experience, when you were a CO, who would come to you with an agency need?
So, excuse me. Primarily, I did this. I performed that function at the base level. So, you know, we ran a municipality, I guess you could say. Typically, it was the ultimate user. If we needed a building built, it was someone from the civil engineering group. If it was custodial services, et cetera, who come from the various branches and divisions of the organizations that needed things. And for the most part, the requirements were routine in nature and could be planned ahead. You know, the second half of that statement, Steve, from 7.104 also notes that this should be done preferably well in advance of the fiscal year in which the contract award or order placement is necessary. And so for the most part, that was accomplished. But then, of course, there were the oddball issues that came up at the last minute, kind of getting us close to the survey question that we began with, which was always an interesting thing, a problem to solve as well.
So the end user customer is often, matter of fact, most often the individual who's going to come to the procurement shop and say, hey, we have something that we need, and we'd like to have you acquire it. And I'm glad you added, Matt, the whole concept of, and oh, by the way, the acquisition plan should occur prior, at least prior to the year to when you expect to expend funds. And the reason for that is the government needs to make sure that they have budgeted money for what this need is going to cost. Because heaven forbid the end user customer comes to a contracting officer and says, I need this. And the contracting officer says, well, our budget's full. You know, you might have to wait. So it's important for us to focus not only on a technical need during a procurement, but also budgetary requirements. The FAR Council also tells us that the membership of the acquisition team and who is needed to be consulted is very, very important. Because a procurement, the procurement is not just created by the contract shop. It's not just created by the contracting officer. There are others who are providing feedback to the contracting officer. Now, Matt, I always find it interesting. And Patrick, I'm not sure if we're able to do this, but I'd love to ask all of you, true or false, the acquisition planner who's identified in FAR Part 7 is always the contracting officer. True or false? The acquisition planner who has all these responsibilities in FAR Part 7.
All right, you should see, always, I think it popped up.
Is always the contracting officer. All right.
We have 100% false.
And fantastic. Maybe I teed it up too easily, Matt, but you're absolutely right. In past seasons, it's been a little bit of a mixed bag. People said, oh, it's got to be the contracting officer, right? They're talking about planning the contract. But one of the things that we need to understand, we're talking about acquisition planning as established in FAR Part 7. It's almost like, Matt, we're planning the program.
Mm-hmm.
We're planning not just the procurement, we're planning the program. What do we see? And you're absolutely right. The correct answer is false. It's not the contracting officer. And I've actually had a couple of participants, Matt, in years past. And, well, Steve, I'm from Missouri. Show me. Tell me why I'm not correct. And I always say, well, if we take a look at FAR 7.104C, it says the planner shall coordinate and secure the concurrence of the contracting officer in all acquisition planning. And the very nature of that statement tells me it's not always going to be the CO, because you're actually, it's not talking about coordinating with someone else or getting the concurrence or agreement with someone else. Now, it would be true, Matt, if we were to say, does the contracting officer need to concur or approve the acquisition plan? I think the answer to that would probably be true. Yes, they do. They need to be involved. And I've often had, Matt, folks ask me, well, Steve, if it's not the CO, who might be the acquisition planner? And I often will say, in my experience, it's often the person within the government who's been designated as the program manager or deputy program manager, who is going to be responsible for the program once the contract is awarded. And again, because one of the things we're going to talk about in later episodes is how this program manager functions. And often on a major procurement, the program manager actually has the contracting officer below him or her, along with other technical folks, and often a budget officer. So the program manager is at the top of that pyramid and is responsible for the overall program itself. The success of the program is on that one individual. So in this case, the program manager. Matt, in your experience, what has been your, what would be the answer to this? Was it often you were the acquisition planner, or was the program folks more involved?
Yeah, it depended on where I was. So when I was doing base level work, which is what I referred to earlier, you know, relatively low dollars there. It was always the contracting, someone in contract who was responsible for that. Now, when I moved to Los Angeles and worked in the Space and Missile Systems Center, there it was always the program manager. Because as you noted, that's the individual who has both the responsibilities and all the powers of making sure that program runs properly. So he or she, I think, properly had that power to kind of keep planning going.
FAR 7.104 talks about who's responsible for building the plan. Now, of course, the planner is the person who's actually going to be writing down or developing the plan. But the FAR Council tells the planner, you know, the contracting officer is important, but the planner should also reach out to the fiscal, the budgetary folks, the legal folks, because you want to make sure that the contract and eventually is going to be legally effective. It's going to have the proper contract provisions in it. Technical personnel, because often technical personnel are going to help the planner develop maybe the statement of work, the statement of service, the performance work statement. The FAR Council says, planner, you need to reach out to small business specialists within the agency, because the government needs to make sure that how the need is expressed and the procurement approach will enable the government to reach out and contract with small businesses. With regard to competition, and we talked about this in FAR Part 6. If the government decides we need to assert one of these exceptions and we're not going to award this contract on a full and open competition basis, the acquisition plan needs to be reviewed and concurred by the advocate for competition, the advocate for competition. So to some extent, Matt, it kind of goes towards, it's interesting that in FAR Part 6, there's a dollar threshold that says who needs to approve it, right? The actual award. The competition advocate's not required to sign it. But if there's an acquisition plan developed by the government, then the competition advocate at least is going to have to sign off on the plan, on the chop sheet, that, yeah, this is an instance where procuring this on an other than full and open competition basis is appropriate.
And if we could jump in into our first password of the day. Our first password of the day is SY, S-Y, SY. Make sure everyone writes this down. All right.
Fantastic. All right. So we talked about when, we talked about who. Now let's talk about what is in an acquisition plan. And I'm going to back up, Matt. Back in the day when I was in-house counsel working for private sector contractors, I often was approached by folks in not our contract shop, but our business and development organizations. and they would ask Steve, which sections of the FAR should I be knowledgeable about or that I should have a basic understanding of? And I would always tell them FAR Part 6, FAR Part 7, FAR Part 10, and FAR Part 11. And I actually created programs for our business development folks on those particular FAR parts. And the reason for that is there is an opportunity for government contractors to help, as we refer to it, Matt, shape a procurement. Mm-hmm. And when Matt and I use the terminology shape a procurement, it means that we're having communications with the government prior to a solicitation being reached. Because remember, we're still in this pre-solicitation stage of a procurement. And part of that dialogue often is providing industry comment or industry experience for some of the statements or some of the facts that a contracting officer, or in this case, an acquisition planner, Matt, needs to create. Now, I don't want to say that a contractor necessarily wants to hand over to the government a draft acquisition plan. Because, Matt, that's fraught with peril, right?
That can cause you some trouble, yeah.
Okay. We want to avoid what's called an organizational conflict of interest. We're going to talk about that in another episode. Because if an organizational conflict of interest exists, it may prohibit a contractor from bidding or proposing for a government solicitation. We don't want that. But there are certain things that the government might need help with. And that kind of ties into FAR Part 7 as well as FAR Part 10. So what is the contracting officer or the planner, what are they responsible for creating in the acquisition plan? Well, really there's two parts. There's two parts. And the contents of the acquisition plan is set forth at FAR 7.105. And for those of you who haven't reviewed that yet, I suggest that you do, because it provides, Matt, an amazing roadmap to the entire acquisition. The acquisition plan is procurement sensitive information for a reason, because it gives you an insight into what the government's thinking about this program. So the first part of an acquisition plan is known as the acquisition background and objectives. That first part, when developed, is used to assess the actual need for the supply or service. It often will end up resulting in the text of your statement of work, the text of your performance work statement. So when we look at 7.104, A, the things that the government is required to develop, or that the subjects that they need to address or assess, are things like the description of the work. What is the cost? What, in this case, the government has not yet reached out and received any proposals or bids. The FAR Council is telling the government acquisition planner, there's a need for you to assess the potential costs. And that normally, Matt, is developed through internal agency resources. It might be, and those internal agency resources are using government information. They might be looking back at what other procurements for that same supplier service cost. It might involve information received from contractors, during the pre-solicitation stage. And we're going to talk about how the government does that. But ultimately, the plan should have an internal government cost estimate. And it's often referred to as the IGCE, the Internal Government Cost Estimate. It's very, very important. And Matt, I've often seen the IGCE might not necessarily be a specific sum certain, but it might be a broad broad band. Probably less than this, probably more than this, but less than that. I often see that in the construction type contracts. Mm-hmm. Where a band of potential estimated costs are. The government needs to talk about or understand deliverable requirements, because that's important as far as when it's needed. The government needs to assess in advance, Matt, are there any trade-offs that we need to consider between technical cost, management, schedule that we expect might be needed for us to make an eventual contract award. And then ultimately, the government's got to do a risk assessment. What do we think are the potential cost risks, the technical risks, the management risks that we understand today prior to issuing the contract award? Because often those costs, those risks might affect the ultimate price that the government has to pay.
And it's interesting you raised the topic of shaping the procurement earlier, and you explained it well, but I want to again reiterate it. It sounds untoward to some people, but it's not just a practical reality of conducting business with any customer, but with also the government. But in a case like this, we're talking about planning and risk assessment. Who do you think knows best of what the possible risks are of performing certain work, delivering certain work, what the kind of schedules are possible to achieve? It's not necessarily, sometimes it is, but it's not typically government personnel. It's going to be contractors. And so that's, I mean, early on here in the ACT planning process, we're already talking about the need, in my opinion, of discussion and dialogue between the government and the contractors to just establish, not the need. The need is the need. The government needs something. But how can it be done? You know, what we're going to get into later about contract type and all kinds of other things. These are choices that need to be made. And without input from contractors, what can happen is you get into the formal solicitation phase and you get a bunch of contractors submitting questions to the Q&A saying, you know, this doesn't really work for us. Have you thought about that? And if the government pivots, that could easily set them back 6, 9, 12 months. So it's best to accomplish this early on.
And also, Matt, you know, we talked about rearranging the sections of the FAR.
Right.
I probably would also put market research, right, FAR Part 10 before acquisition plan, because there's a presumption that the planner is receiving market research from the people who he or she is working with. There is that presumption that there's information out there that needs to be grabbed.
Mm-hmm.
And that will be included in the acquisition plan. When you're assessing, for example, in this first part of the acquisition plan, the assessment of the need, how the need will be expressed in your contract. The government, the FAR Council also tells contracting officers in this first part to also take into consideration acquisition streamlining. And that often will involve what type of procurement will be utilized. Because one of the things we're going to talk about at a later date, Matt, there's multiple ways the government can acquire an item. You know, it could be through a if it's a small dollar value, using simplified acquisition thresholds. If it is a commercial item, the government might utilize FAR Part 12. Which allows you to do things that you couldn't do on a non-commercial item. And we've already talked about one in our discussion about FAR Part 5, that synopsis and solicitation being published at the same time. The government might decide, Matt, we're going to issue an invitation for bid. which is a completely different type of procurement that we're going to talk about in our discussion of FAR Part 14. Or the government might make the decision that we're going to utilize negotiated procurement procedures and utilize a FAR Part 15 type procurement, which of course is often more lengthy. The acquisition life cycle is longer than a commercial item procurement under FAR Part 12, or if available under a GSA federal supply schedule issued under FAR Part 8. And we're going to go into those particular types of procurements, as I said, in later episodes. The second part of an acquisition plan is identified as a plan of action. And that's at 7.105B as in boy. Those particular facts and determinations that are set forth in part of subsection B is used to establish and assess how the acquisition will be conducted. How the acquisition will be conducted. And what I mean by that is the acquisition plan needs to identify, for example, are there small businesses available to the government to provide a supplier service within the expected delivery schedule that's established in the first part? And if the answer is that, then the government needs to consider whether to use a small business set aside. And we're going to talk about that at a later date as far as what that entails. Or are only large businesses capable of doing that? The government needs to assess whether there is the ability to unbundle the requirements that's been established in the first part. Meaning, is there a way for us to break up a very broadly written statement of work?
Mm-hmm.
So we can give an opportunity for potentially a small business to be awarded a prime contract. There might be an instance where the government, in the second part of the acquisition plan, the government looks at specific requirements. And again, is there a way for us to identify areas that a small business can provide? And is there an instance where we might want to establish in our solicitation certain small business set aside requirements for the prime? The government in part two also needs to identify whether we're going to use full and open competition, or is there an instance where the requirement stated might allow the government to use a limited source of contractors? Or is a sole source award of a basis of available to us? The government needs to identify in this acquisition plan what contract type it might need or should use. Is it a service contract where time and materials or labor hour is more appropriate than cost reimbursement? Is this an instance where the supply that we have is a commercial item and the government knows that it can't use a cost reimbursement contract? It has to use firm fixed price, time and materials, or labor hour. And we're going to talk about contract type in our discussion of FAR Part 16 at a later date. But these are some of the things that need to be discussed. Government's also going to talk about the evaluation criteria, Matt. What's more important to the government to procure this service or supply? Is technical more important? Is price more important? Is it going to be a procurement where the government decides we're going to award this on the best price? Or is the government going to say, we understand there's going to be trade-offs and we might not award to the lowest price, but given that there might be technical advantages on the other side. All of these things are going to be discussed within the government. And then more often than not, Matt, is then going to get created and set forth in the solicitation in Section M. The government's going to make an identification, it's going to figure out, okay, how long do we think we have this need? Is it recurring or is this a one-off? And if there is a recurring need, how many years do we think we want to have for a particular contract? And we're going to have a discussion about multiple year contracts and multi-year contracts later on in the show. But the government needs to identify this. How long do we think we're going to need it? And more often than not, Matt, why might the government decide to use a multiple year contract as opposed to saying, well, it's a recurring need, but we're only going to issue a procurement for 1 year?
Question to me, why would we do it that way?
Yeah, what's the advantage of a multiple year contract?
There are pros and cons to both, but I'd say the overriding decision maker is going to be your funding source and the rules that are in the color of money.
You've identified a need that's recurring. You're going to save money on acquisition costs. You're going to save money potentially because you are going to award a contract that a contractor knows is going to be for a longer period of time, which is always a good thing for a contractor. Contractors like long-term contracts. Because more often than not, when the government establishes in a solicitation, it says, here's a contract for one base year with what we'll call 4 year options. Potentially the entire length of that contract could be 5 years. Contractors like that because they know if they continue to do good work and if they've done their own due diligence and know that there's probably no budgetary issues with this program, they know they've got a long-term contract that's going to bring in long-term revenue for them. The government likes long-term contracts, Matt, because, again, as you said, they know how much something's going to cost over a period of time. So the contracting officer is not going to have to go back to the finance or budgetary folks and say, I need more money here because we hadn't planned for this. So that's an advantage. The contract, the acquisition plan is also going to deal with, is going to need to take into account logistics. If you're talking about data rights, is there a need for government furnished property or information? Is there a need to take into account environmental or energy objectives? And are there any specific security considerations that need to take into account? And we're going to talk about some of the government's new security requirements in a later episode. All of these things need to take into account. One of the things I love about this roadmap, Matt, is it allows a contractor, a smart contractor, to kind of understand, okay, where does our potential offering, how does that fit with regard to all these requirements? And what might be in our best interest when we're trying to sell it to the government or to shape that procurement? Like, for example, if you have a state-of-the-art security system that is fully compliant with all the government's needs, you might want to say those requirements are important and they should be in your solicitation because we think it's in the best interest of the government. If you are a commercial item provider, it's incumbent upon you to explain to the government in these pre-solicitation acquisition planning meetings to say, we can provide and meet your need with the commercial supplies that we have in place or with a commercial service that we provide to other government customers on a commercial item basis or to private sector commercial customers. You want to tee a lot of these things up in your meetings with the government, because eventually what you hope is that the things that you have to your advantage eventually will show up in this acquisition plan, which again, I always say, Matt, the acquisition plan is the homework that you do to take the test, which is to create the procurement, to create that solicitation. The acquisition plan is your skeleton, to some extent, to what eventually is going to show up in the solicitation that, as a contractor, you hope to receive and go, this is great. All the things that the government has identified as important are things that we can do. Mm-hmm. And we might be able to do better than others. So that's something to take into account. The government, the FAR Council talks about multiple issues in FAR Part 7. Of course, we can't address them all. It talks about using, the government should apply economic quantities. Only purchase what you need. Don't ask for more than you need, but ask for enough that's going to create some kind of cost effectiveness for the government. Matt, the classic case here, I always say, is major aircraft programs. The government often won't say to a contractor, we need 1,000 jets, state-of-the-art jets. They often will say, build us 20, mm-hmm. because they know 1,000 is going to cost too much. But they know 20 is enough where the contractor is going to be able to succeed and want to participate, because it's a quantity. And what the government refers to as an economic quantity. The FAR Council in FAR Part 7 also talks about leasing of equipment. The acquisition plan, if you're buying equipment, needs to take into account, is the government going to build the equipment? Is it going to rent equipment? Or is it going to lease equipment? So if you have a procurement for equipment, that is another subsection that is going to be in your acquisition plan. And each one comes with its various pros and cons. The last thing I want to talk about briefly is what's known as an inherently governmental function. And Matt and I have talked about this before. The bottom line, and this is established in subpart 7.5, is the government cannot acquire services from a contractor that has been reserved to the federal government, I'll say under the Constitution. If you take a look at 7.503, it sets forth a list of or examples of services. And the FAR Council says this is not exhausting, but it talks to us about what is considered an inherently governmental function. And you'll see it often deals with things like criminal prosecution, criminal investigation. It talks about things like war fighting. But for our purposes, as government contracting participants, the FAR Council tells the government you should never acquire services that will grant a contractor the right to award a contract, terminate a contract, modify a contract. But that same section in 7.503 tells the government you can't grant those functions to a government contractor, but they can play a supporting role to those functions. A contracting officer often might have a support function that is being performed by a contractor. The evaluation board that has been assigned to provide the contracting officer their opinion as to who should be awarded a contract may have a supporting function performed by a contractor. Those supporting functions by a contractor will always require the contractor to be subject to non-disclosure agreements, will often require the contractor to understand that if you provide this function, you will not be able to be awarded certain contracts. Certainly any contracts that you might have any relationship to with. And there are often government contractors, Matt, that their sole function is to provide a supporting role to the government. Mm-hmm. And they've already agreed, we're not interested in doing these contracts. We would rather be a supporting function to our government customer in those certain roles. But 7.503 provides a wonderful list of the of those instances where the government cannot and the instances where the government can procure certain services or functions. All right, I'm going to give a I had fun with the FAR stress toy to the first person who can tell me where you can find the definition of the inherent of an inherently governmental function. And here's a hint. It's not in FAR Part 7. No. Okay, so up, we got a winner. Patrick.
We got Dan You're Donovan.
Absolutely correct. Or the, no, answer have... is, the answer Sorry. Is where we find a lot of definitions, Matt, at FAR 2.101.
Yep.
All right, Amy Collins. FAR 2.101.
So now, Amy, one of the things that we always need to remember when we talk about definitions is if there was a definition in FAR Part 7, that would supersede any definition that's in 2.101. But in this case, there isn't. So for those of you who are interested in reading what the definition is of an inherently governmental function, you need to go back to 2.101, and it's there.
Yes.
Yeah, so all right. Are we ready for another password?
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say. I was going to say, Amy, keep your eye on the chat. I'm going to send my email. Then you can send me your mailing address for the stress ball. And our second password of the day is Sims, S-Y-M-S. Sims, S-Y-M-S. Remember to write this down, everyone.
All right, Matt, let's jump into FAR Part 10.
All right.
Which I always like to say. There's some irony to FAR Part 10. And the irony is, it's one of the shortest parts of the FAR. And yet I also say it's probably one of the most important. Market research is critical to the success of any federal procurement. And when I refer to market research, I'm referring not only getting information, as we talked about earlier, from the internal systems of the US government. It also involves getting information from industry, from interested industry participants in your procurement. The first step, to some extent, always should be, well, Matt, who's bought this before?
Mm-hmm.
Who within my agency has bought this product or service? And logically, the first person that you might want to pick up the phone, type up an email, or I'm hoping people are starting to do this, maybe walk down the halls and say, hey, this type of procurement's new to me. Someone just told me that you did this a few years back. Can you help me out here? Can you share with me information or, maybe a lesson's learned? Wouldn't that be great, Matt? What was done right? What was done wrong? So we can do this very, very quickly and hopefully in the best interest of the government with regard to technical costs and management. It could be your agency has never procured this supplier service before. So you might want to go to an internal government database. And we're going to talk about those databases in a few weeks, and do some automated research. Again, looking at what other agencies have bought, how long that contract was, how much they spent, who the awardees were, Matt. And again, after getting that information, picking up the phone, typing out an email to maybe to that contracting officer who was identified, and getting some information. I will give a I had fun with the FAR winter cap, for those of you who are still in the cold, to the first person to tell me what government database might a contracting officer utilize to get information about other agency procurements. And we talked about it. Oh, we got a winner. Sam.gov. Patrick, who won that winner beanie?
That was Lori Robinson. And Lori, if you just look right above your comment, you'll see my email. Just send me your mailing address. What did you say the prize was again, Steve?
We're going to give her the winter cap. I'm hoping she's in some place that's cold.
Perfect.
Where that she eventually either need it today or maybe in a few weeks or maybe next year. But that's the prize. I'd love to get there. Congratulations, Lori. Good job. Sam.gov is a great research tool. Matt, when are agencies required to use market research?
Generally speaking, at every phase of the procurement, but of course, the FAR says as appropriate, which I think unfortunately means many agency personnel don't bother with this. I believe it's actually spelled out in here. Yeah, it is in the policy section. We have requirements to conduct market research, before developing new requirements documents, before soliciting offers, really at every phase. And like you were saying before, the sequence of events of what we're talking about today and how the FAR lays it out is interesting, because really market research, even just, you know, preliminary informal market research, should be done, if not at the very beginning of ACT planning, maybe even a little bit before, just as you said, to kind of get the world and understand the universe of what's actually out there and available. I know Part 10 is really geared toward commercial item designation of commercial, non-commercial. That's really what most of the text refers to. But it's also very important for all the other important aspects of acquisition planning when it comes to small business participation and other things, because as the agency reaches out to companies or individuals who have knowledge of the industry and ask questions about how various requirements can be satisfied, you can also learn a lot about, again, the level of potential competition you're going to see. Maybe the requirement needs to be changed. That's an ACT planning question, ultimately, that next phase. What kind of small businesses are out there that can do the work and things of that nature. So it should be done at every phase, frankly. I'm not sure where it actually ends. I guess when you issue the solicitation is when that market research phase kind of necessarily ends.
The FAR Council tells us at a minimum, the market research needs to be performed. It doesn't say how much, Matt. That's the interesting. It doesn't say how much you need to do, because it depends, right? When you're developing a new requirement, so no one else has bought it before. Mm-hmm. It tells us, the FAR Council tells us, if the solicitation, if the acquisition has an estimated value greater than $250,000, or if it goes higher, the stated small acquisition threshold, simplified acquisition threshold. If before soliciting any offers that will result in a bundled contract, term of art, a bundled contract. And that's when the government has decided to put together two stated requirements in our particular contract that were previously performed individually into a single contract. Market research needs to be done, because you need to support whether that is in the government's interest versus the promotion of small business contracting. And it also says, before soliciting offers under an IDIQ contract, an indefinite delivery, indefinite quantity contract for a non-commercial item in excess of the simplified acquisition threshold. Those instances where market research is required. But again, doesn't necessarily tell us how much or not. But what is fascinating What is fascinating is if the government has performed market research, Matt, and circumstances have not changed, and 18 months have not passed, the government does not need to do new market research. It can rely on that prior research that the agency performed. Notwithstanding those other thresholds that we just talked about, where it says you must do this. There is that exception. It's an 18-month exception. And again, it presumes that the stated need has not changed. It doesn't go stale until after 18 months have passed. The FAR Council also tells us that while a lot of folks, Matt, when you read just FAR Part 10, they make a presumption that it's only for the government. But the last, very last subpart in FAR Part 10 talks about the requirements that the market research requirements that need to be performed for contractors. And a lot of people go, what? The FAR Council makes clear and tells contracting officers, if you have a contract that you're going to award that has an estimated value greater than $6 million, you have an obligation to incorporate a contract clause that states and tells the prime contractor, to the extent that you intend to subcontract to another party for a subcontract in excess of the SAT, the Simplified Acquisition Threshold, Matt, you need to do market research. And you need to have, and I'll tell you, you not only need to perform it, but you need to document that you did it and what your findings were. The one major exception, Matt, to that is unless you're subcontracting for a commercial product or a commercial service. So if you have 52.210-1 in your prime contract and you intend to subcontract, the government's going to have an expectation that you can show them that you perform some market research. And the government may also ask you, can you show us what your findings were?
So, and I think it's interesting that this shows up, this clause shows up in Part 10. I, as you introduced this concept, I don't think too many people even know about this, because of course, most people view Part 10, as you said, a government's only part of the FAR. I wonder why, or maybe my recommendation to the FAR Council is, as we make these, as we go through all these slides, you know, if this were in Part 44, I bet you would get a lot more attention.
Absolutely. Now, I'm going to throw out a question to you all. You're a contracting officer. What are the types of, what do you think is the most important reason to perform market research? And again, that's for all of you out there. That's not for my good friend Matt over here. What do you think is the most important reason to do market research?
Well, I'm happy to share my view when the results are in, because I I have one thought.
Competition, yeah. Best price, cost and pricing. Competition. Will there be competition? Best value. Products and price available. I like that. Is there an existing product, Matt, that's available to the government? Identify sources. Fairness and reasonableness. Requirements and risk. I like these answers. Innovation. The market, this market research that is going to be performed is, from my perspective, Matt, other than time and maybe a little bit of cost, there's no downside to do market research, especially if it's done well. You're going to have a wealth of information at your hands as a buyer. As a buyer, you're going to have so much information for you to make a good decision as to, first and foremost, how do we want to establish a solicitation for what we need? What is the current state of technology that exists? And do what we as a buyer want to get more? Do we want to promote innovation? Or can we just live with what currently exists? What do we think would be a fair price given what we've researched? Are there any specific conditions or terms that might help the government mitigate risk with regard to technical or cost? Are there any conditions that we might need to take into consideration to ensure competition? The FAR Council tells the government, competition is so important because, as we talked about a few weeks ago, competition promotes innovation and competition reduces price. So to the extent that you are finding through research that this is available, that's helpful. I love the fact that someone just wrote in an informed buyer is the best buyer. Absolutely. Absolutely. As Cy Sims has told us, at least from his perspective, as a store owner, an educated customer was always his favorite, right? An educated customer is the best customer. And the same applies here for the government buyer. Where or how the government should perform market research? FAR 10.002, B as in boy, 2, provides a wonderful list, Matt, of techniques that the FAR Council tells buyers, use these. Doesn't say you have to use all of them, but it says, here is our ways for you to do adequate research, adequate market research. And the laundry list includes consult knowledgeable individuals within government and in industry. And Matt, in a few weeks, we're going to talk about the government's what's called the Mythbusters. Mm-hmm. Because many contracting professionals within the government, I'm not sure it necessarily is as bad as it used to be, are so hesitant and worried about talking to industry because they're for some reason they feel like I can't do that. And I often will take them to FAR Part 10 and say, look, the FAR Council tells you, consult with us. It's okay. Within certain parameters, it's okay. Especially again, if we're in the acquisition planning stage, a solicitation has not hit the street, you're not evaluating awards. This is the period of time where you're trying to get from me, a contractor, what is the state of the art? What have I done before? What are my thoughts as to how the government has identified a need? The use of requests for information, Matt, RFIs. Can you talk to us a little bit about what an RFI is, and more importantly, what it's not?
Well, I hope I can answer the what it's not, but I can definitely say what it is, and it's a request for information to industry. It could be conveyed in a number of ways, although it's an option on SAM when you're actually on the list of communications with the world. You can issue an RFI to seek information about what, as you said, what the state of the art is, what companies are capable of doing the work that's being contemplated. It's a great tool for that. but I don't know what it's not. I don't know what you're getting at there.
It's not a request for proposals.
There you go. That's very true.
When a contractor responds to an RFI, the government then can't use that information as a basis to award a contract. And in fact, the standard template for an RFI that's issued by the government should always say, this is not a request for proposals. This is a request for information. But the government should also tell contractors, but anything you provide to us will keep closely held. We're not going to share it with others, provided that you, contractor, mark it in a way that tells me what I can or can't use it for. But it's a great utility to get industry information. I also love when the government issues pre-solicitations, draft solicitations for industry to respond to and to potentially mark up. Tell us how we can improve on the statement of work. Tell us how we can improve on this performance work statement. Tell us whether we've got the evaluation criteria right. Tell us whether we've got the delivery schedule right, which is going to take us to FAR Part 11, Matt, which is describing needs. The government is going to use market research. The government is going to use the acquisition plan to identify in a solicitation a stated need. And the FAR Council tells us that after performing good market research and acquisition planning, the government should be able to understand whether full and open competition is required or not. It'll be able to tell the government what is the existing technology, and is it in the government's best interest, Matt, to ask for a particular brand name or not? Traditionally, the FAR Council tells the government, do not, I repeat, do not include a restrictive requirement which will cause only one contractor to be able to respond. Do not do that, government. And if you do, someone can challenge an award on that basis unless other circumstances exist. But the bottom line, as a general rule, restrictive requirements are prohibited. The stated need should take into account whether the government intends to or does not intend to procure commercial items. That's a requirement. Another source that basically promotes industry communication is found at FAR 11.002C as in Charlie. This is a very, very important statement in the FAR if you're a business development individual for a contractor. 11.002C as in Charlie. It states, I very rarely will quote something, but this one's important. To the extent practicable and consistent with subpart 9.5, which talks about organizational conflicts of interest, potential offerors should be given an opportunity to comment on agency requirements or to recommend application and tailoring of requirements documents and alternative approaches. That is a statement and guidance to a contracting officer. It's okay to get input and have a dialogue with government contractors. Matt, let's jump into 11.4, which is delivery schedules. It's important that the government establishes a schedule that is achievable. And how do you know whether a schedule is achievable or not? Hopefully it's because you've done good market research. If it's not achievable, you very likely might not get any responses. If it's not achievable, you very likely will not get the product or service on time.
Well, yeah, you get at a really important issue that, again, shows up throughout the FAR and anyone who's procuring and buying things professionally. The risk of failure I think we all delude ourselves into thinking that failure by another party to a contract, that the cost of that is going to be borne by that party. And that's not the case, right? At the end of the day, if the government's buying something because the government needs it, if it sets requirements, in this case, too restrictively or whatever it happens to be, it's the government that suffers the consequence of that. Maybe the government can go sue somebody, but in all likelihood, that's not going to get you anywhere. So, yes.
If the government does not establish a reasonable schedule, more often than not, they're going to pay too much.
Can't be accomplished, but people bid and win it anyway. Well, there you could be blowing away a whole year of planning or more when you have to go back to the drawing board. So that's always a really important consideration.
The last thing I want to talk about is really, really quick. Liquidated damages. Liquidated damages are used only when schedule is critical. The calculation of liquidated damages and how the government should present it in a solicitation is in 11.500. It can't be, the liquidated damages can only be used when the government cannot assess its true damages if a product or service is not delivered on time. And they have to use a calculation that reasonably assesses what they believe the damages could be. Liquidated damages are normally asserted on a day-by-day process. For every day late, you might be charged a certain amount. That amount cannot be considered punitive. The government cannot continue to assess liquidated damages over a period of time and then decide to terminate. The government has to very, very early in this whole process needs to determine which solution do we want. And through what's called equity, the government cannot continue to charge liquidated damages for a period of time and then hit the government or the contractor with potential termination costs. The FAR Council makes very, very clear. It has to be within a reasonable period of time. The last thing we can talk about very briefly is priorities and allocations. The DPAS system, Defense Priorities and Allocation System, is established by the government, and it's controlled by the Department of Commerce to allow the government to order specific services and supplies that often are limited to a list in the DPAS regulations. They can't be used for everything, and they're normally identified with regard to things that deal with emergencies, with regard to national security and homeland security. In those instances, the government can tell a contractor, you are required to provide this product and service for a period of time only to us. And if you're currently working on a federal government contract, there will be a box that identifies whether your contract is a rated order or not. There'll be a check. If it's checked, it says a rated order, and then it will be identified as either a DO or DX rated order. What that means is if there is an emergency and the government needs the product or service that is subject to that contract, they can tell you, we're your sole customer. You cannot provide, you have to shut down your commercial line or shut down your line to any other customer and only provide that product or service to us until we tell you otherwise. If you're not currently working under a federal government contract, the government could issue an order under DPAS and say, we need this product or service. But the government doesn't set those terms. Those are still going to be negotiated terms. But one of the things the customer needs to understand is after negotiating those terms, they can only provide that product and service to the government until they tell you otherwise for the length of your contract. It was recently used during COVID, Matt, with regard to PPE, with regard to vaccinations. But if you were a current government contractor, you need to understand that if your box is checked and you have customers, commercial customers for that same product or service, that your commercial customers will, their supply chain is going to be disrupted if the government says, we control your lines now. So it's incumbent upon you, if you've got commercial customers, to make sure you have a force majeure clause that says, in the event of a government order, that basically, Matt, allows us to not be subject to termination and or any other damages that might arise because we're not providing you with those products or services on a timely basis. You need to make sure that receipt of a government order or the government's action will be considered a force majeure. That takes us to, we got one more password, Patrick?
We do have one more password that we will do right now. Our last password of the day is wife, W-I-F-E. Wife, right. W-I-F-E.
That takes us to the end of this episode. I want you all to know that we're going to start meeting. We're going to have a pre-show meeting with any of you interested. Just sign in early, probably about 10 minutes before the next show, where we can talk about anything that we might not be able to address in our FAR parts. A lot of times we're sharing trivia, people are winning prizes. So if you want to join us a little early, 2 weeks from now, love to talk with you all. So until we meet you and talk to you again on March 8th, work hard, play fair, and go farther. Thanks for joining us.
I'm just going to put up one last poll here. We'd love to hear our feedback. Let's go put it up on the screen now. And yes, thank you all so much. Thank you to our expert instructors, Steve and Matt, and thank you all so much for joining us. And do not forget to submit the passwords on the PCI website. Thank you all.